So first of all, I'd like to add my welcome to all of you. I think there is something very precious and very important about having urban-based retreats. You know, very often people's retreat experience is to go somewhere much more cloistered, much more removed from their lives, and there is something very valuable and important about having those spaces to deepen. And yet to practice on a day like this, very close to the rest of our life, very close to our relationships, our work, our places where we live, I think is where we learn some very important skills in this practice about how to let go, about how to create more space inwardly, about not always just investing long retreats with the places where we find some inner peace or some inner calm or some insight, but about learning to practice in the midst of sounds, in the midst of, you know, a busy city, and to really know very much, as the Buddha really so stressed it, that the real freedom of our heart, the real peace of our heart, cannot always be given into the hands of conditions. That, you know, we can strive in our lives to cultivate the very best conditions that we can. And yet if we feel or believe inwardly that inner peace, inner calm, inner spaciousness relies upon having perfect conditions in our life, this is probably going to remain a very elusive goal. And certainly I think the very thrust, the very essence of some of the Buddhist teaching is to transform that way of thinking and to look inwardly at our own minds, to look inwardly at our own hearts, to look inwardly at our own responses to the world of conditions, and here to cultivate what we most long for, what we most value, and perhaps the very qualities of calmness, of spaciousness, of ease are not always as far away from us as they first can seem. So today we have an opportunity to do just that. As Jackie mentioned, it is helpful to have an agreement, to have a sort of collective agreement that we will hold the day in silence. There will, of course, be times in here for some questions, some dialogue, but sometimes just to allow ourselves to stop talking for a while is actually a great gift in terms of being able to really look inwardly. The kind of silence we have on retreats is not the kind of silence that some of you may have been more familiar with in your histories, of being a kind of punitive silence or a withdrawal of affection or a way of being cut off. It is actually using verbal silence as a means to connecting more deeply with the quietude of our own hearts, the quietude of our own minds, and to be able to listen. And for me, this is always the most precious part of silence, is that capacity or that gift that it offers for us to enhance our capacity to listen to the life of our bodies, to listen to the life of our hearts and minds, to listen to the sounds of the world. Now the theme I want to loosely hang this day-long retreat around is the theme of cultivating joy in the path. But of course when I speak about this as a cultivating joy in the path, it really is an encouragement not just to think about how do I have more joy on the cushion, you know, or how do I have more joy in my walking path? But really, what is the way that we cultivate more joy in our lives? You know, and in my understanding, the Buddha never just taught formal meditation practice, that the real heart of the Buddha's teaching was the cultivation of an awakened life. And if we have that much more expansive view of this teaching, then we understand in a very real way that the whole of our life is actually our path. That our path is not just about what happens when we sit and close our eyes. It's about what happens when we engage with the world, how we relate to those we love and those we struggle with, how we relate to the world of busyness and doing, how in this wider sense of a path do we learn to cultivate a more joyful heart. Take a moment to reflect on how we think about joy. I think some of the associations that come to people's minds when we think about joy is often in the kind of framework of sort of a kind of euphoric experience, a kind of exalted experience, often more in the extremes. Or when we think about joy, we might think of, you know, the innocent joyfulness of children, their capacity to find delight and joy in the most smallest details of life. And it is, I think, it's certainly my perception, which may be completely a misperception, that as much as we all long for joy in our life, and I think this is a genuine and a noble longing, to have that longing for joy in our life, we can often feel to have much less than we would like to have. And I think it is true, the experience of many people who live in this world is that we find ourselves often feeling a little burdened by the immensity of our doing, sometimes a little burdened by the whole spectrum of tragedies and difficulties and adversity that can come into our life that none of us are exempt from. But much of this can somehow at times seem to a little bit stifle or a little bit even suffocate that sense of gladness, that sense of joy in our life. And then I think we can also tend to become a little bit dualistic. And we think that when this particular issue in my life is over, you know, when I've resolved my relationship problems, you know, when I've got the right job, you know, when I have a better boss or better colleagues, then that'll be the moment when joy returns to my life, because I will have cleared the decks. Again, I think this is not a helpful way to always think, because I think that way of thinking can be a very direct cause of a whole lot of agitation in our life. You know, how do I fix this? How do I get rid of this? How do I rearrange this? And once more, we're in that place of delivering the well-being of our hearts into the hands of conditions. So I think for many of us, you know, it's a generalization, but for many of us, the real question is it possible to cultivate a gladness of heart, a sense of spaciousness, a quality of ease within all of the conditions in our life in which nothing has to go away and nothing has to be fixed, and that we're not engaging in postponement practice, which says later, you know, when I've got the ideal life. Postponement practice in my experience is never very helpful. But when we get much more into the practice of immanence, where is the joy, the gladness in this moment? What is it that enables that? What allows that to come into being? I'd like to read you a poem by Mary Oliver. She says, every day I see or I hear something that more or less kills me with delight, that leaves me like a needle in the haystack of light. It is what I was born for, to look, to listen, to lose myself inside this soft world, to instruct myself over and over in joy. An acclamation. Nor am I talking about the exceptional, the fearful, the dreadful, the very extravagant, but of the ordinary, the common, the very drab, the daily presentations. O good scholar, I say to myself, how can you help but grow wise with such teachings as these, the untrimmable light of the world, the ocean's shine, the prayers that I made out of grass. I have a great fondness for this poem because it's also a poem that takes joy and gladness out of these kind of peak experiences and really places it very much in the simplicity of being able to see wholeheartedly, being able to listen wholeheartedly, being able to live our life moment to moment so wholeheartedly. Joy has a context, and the context that I would place a cultivation of joy in is in, of course, the very grist of these teachings. Now, the Buddhist teachings, I think, have a rather poor reputation of being rather grim and rather, really a bit somber and, rather earnest and, getting on with the business of dealing with the difficult. And it's an incomplete perception, I would say. The Buddha made no bones about recognizing the dilemma of this life. I think his great gift, his great talent, was to be able to speak about the very universal, the very human dilemma that each of us meets in our life, rather than trying to wallpaper over it or bandage it or pretend it's not there. And in a way, it is what gives a context for the path. It's what gives a context for the cultivation of the heart. Is a very honest acknowledgement of the way life is. Very simply. One way of, the word, of course, that the Buddha used, and we don't have a good English translation of this, is the Buddha began by acknowledging the dilemma of what is called dukkha. Sometimes described as unsatisfactoriness. But actually, the way that I would sort of tend to describe dukkha is the unarguables. The unarguables that are part of all of our lives. We are born, we age, our bodies get sick, and we die. Everything around us changes, is unstable, is constantly in a state of flux. Moves, there's nothing that will stand still for us, no matter how hard we try to make it stand still. The reality of those changes means that every day in our lives brings us some lessons of loss. And there is sadness in that. The Buddha also spoke of these unarguables in terms of the instability of conditions. We're actually not as much in control as we would like to be. We cannot get up this morning and determine that the sun will shine. We cannot get up this morning and decide that we will only have pleasant people and pleasant thoughts and pleasant body sensations. We're really not that much at the center of the universe, I'm afraid, as much as we would like to convince ourselves that this is so. The reality of dukkha means that we will all have disappointments in our lives. Things change, not always in ways that we welcome. Sometimes we get what we want and sometimes we simply don't. I think of this sort of spectrum of the unarguables. They talk about the sort of universal realities that runs through all of our lives. We all have our personal stories about these unarguables. But, you know, if any one of you was willing to come up here and just speak about your life today, speak about your life yesterday. You know, you would speak about change. You would speak about the things you're having to meet in your body. You would speak about what happens in your mind that's not always satisfactory. You would speak about the losses you've been asked to embrace. You would speak about sometimes the adversity and the pain that are part of this life. And if you turned around and faced this room and spoke about this, you would only have heads nodding in agreement and say, I know this. I know this. So there is a personal dimension to this, but when we actually open our hearts a little bit, we actually really see the universal dimension of all of this. Now, the difficulty, and often what suffocates joy, happiness, kindness, friendliness, I think, in our lives, is the way that we place ourselves in a state of argument with the unarguables. When we say, this shouldn't be happening, you know, why is this happening? What did I do wrong? Does this mean that I'm not good enough? Does this mean that I deserve this? That we place ourselves in the state of argument with the unarguables, often through trying to cling more, through trying to control more, through trying to fix more, through trying to avoid more, and of course if none of that works, we all have our bottom line of distraction. We'll just pretend it's not happening. We'll just try and pretend it's not happening. So the Buddha recognized this, and he said there may be a wiser and a kinder way of meeting the unarguables. And of course, the whole of this path is to do with the transformation of relationship, the transformation of the heart in relationship to the unarguables. And that transformation of the heart is presented in so many different ways in this teaching, through insight, through investigation, through very radical acceptance, through mindfulness, through really exploring the responses, the landscape of our reactions and responses to the unarguables, through stillness, through quietude, through beginning to calm our own hearts. And one of the ways that the Buddha really spoke about transforming the heart, finding a way of being present within the unarguables, in which we're not overwhelmed, in which we don't flounder, in which we don't drown, is through the cultivation of what are called, in this tradition, the Brahma-viharas, the qualities of kindness, the qualities of compassion, the qualities of joy, and the qualities of equanimity. Now, in a very real way, these qualities which the Buddha speaks about as pathways of awakening, pathways of insight, pathways of liberation, these four qualities are not separate qualities. In a very real way, they are so interwoven. And my sense is that joy very much has its roots in what is called metta, our capacity to befriend. Our capacity to befriend all events, all experiences, equally. One way that I really like to translate metta is our willingness to stand near to all things. Our willingness to stand next to all experience, all events. We don't have to love it. There's never any suggestion in this path that suddenly we develop a sort of romantic love of pain or affliction or difficult people. But we may be able to stand next to, near to all experience, letting go of all of the tendencies to flee, to abandon, to fear, to become agitated, to become anxious, that this difficult situation, this pain in the knee, this illness in the body, this difficult thought, this difficult memory, this difficult image or emotion, we may not always have to run. Because the very running and the abandonment and the avoidance, of course, is not only an abandonment and avoidance of what is actually happening in this moment, it is also, I think, an abandonment and an avoidance of our own capacity to find balance and fearlessness and kindness and joy in the midst of all experience. So joy, I would suggest, actually begins with this capacity to befriend, to be present, to be in the midst of all things, in the midst of our life. Now, to do that, of course, to do that actually really begins a lot for a lot of us with our capacity just to calm down a little, to find our ground, to find our feet, to begin to bring our present moment experience into focus, to know what is actually happening. That sounds simple, but very often in our life we actually don't know what is actually happening. We might say, I feel terrible, or I feel sad, or I feel afraid, or I feel sick. Those are very big concepts. Do we know what is actually happening? Are we learning to listen to the life of the body, the life of our mind, to unpack our concepts, and to learn to establish ourselves with kindness, with befriending, with just in this present moment experience? It is why we do what we're doing here. We take the time to step out. We take the time to step back. We take the time not to do so much. And in taking that space and that time, we really offer to ourselves that opportunity just to allow things to slow and to settle a little and to be able to listen. Now, joy in this path, and I will speak much more about this afternoon, is again not about just the peak experiences of delight, but the joy of calmness, the joy of spaciousness, the joy of feeling at home inhabiting our own experience. The sense of ease in inhabiting our own bodies, our own minds, our own hearts, our own life. And we begin by collecting and by gathering and by attending. What we don't do in this practice, and I'm sure you've all experienced the impossibility of this task, we don't try to make ourselves joyful. I don't think that joy is something we can contrive, or that we can force or pretend. What we do a lot in this practice, with mindfulness, with befriending, is we make room for joy to appear, to arise, to be part of our consciousness, part of our hearts. It's about inclining the heart. The Buddha speaks about this a whole lot. We're not trying to make something happen. We're not trying to make ourselves kind. We're not trying to make ourselves compassionate or joyful. We're not trying to make ourselves equanimous. But we're learning that we can incline the heart towards. Can incline the heart towards. I think one of the most central teachings of the Buddha that I'm really fond of is to really contemplate the reality that what we dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind. And that the shape of our mind, in very real ways, becomes the shape of our life. If we dwell upon frustration and irritation and anxiety, we can be sure it will grow. It will deepen. And it becomes the shape of our mind and the very lens through which we shape the world. If we learn the lessons very patiently, very slowly, very mindfully, about how to incline the mind, how to incline the heart towards spaciousness, towards ease, towards calmness, towards kindness, this does indeed start to be the shape of our mind, the shape of our heart. And that too permeates through the whole of our lives. So we'll sit for a little bit. You might, if you want to, just stand up for